I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
We're building bridges. 60 years after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, Black Americans continue to face economic inequality and lack of opportunity.
Diedrich Asante Muhammad, Chief of Organizing Policy and Equity of the National Community Investment Coalition, NCRC, and Sally Sim, Project Specialist of the Organizing Policy and Equity Division with NCRC, thank you for joining us to discuss A Dream Deferred, Over 500 Years of Black Economic Inequality and Counting.
60 years after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, Black Americans continue to face economic inequality and lack of opportunity.
And 60 years ago, King said, "But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Injustice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity in this nation. And so we come to cash this check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and security of justice."
The discussion we are about to engage exists against the backdrop of the March for Jobs and Freedom. And it exists. It exists in the context of now. On August 5th, a group of white voters, for example, in a moment of racial aggression triggered by their sense of entitlement and privilege fueled by white supremacy, attacked Damian Pickett, a Black riverboat captain, after he instructed them to dock their pontoon elsewhere as the space was reserved for a larger vessel. And on this 60th anniversary of the March for Jobs and Freedom, a white gunman, motivated by racial hate, went on a hunt to kill people of African ancestry, first to a historically Black college, and then being denied entrance to the campus. He killed three Black citizens at the nearby dollar store in Jacksonville, in a state governed by the virulent white supremacist, yes, Governor DeSantis.
And last year, 10 Black souls were taken at the Tops supermarket in Buffalo, New York, by another young executioner.
From the daily insults and assaults on Black lives by individual citizens and state actors to their mass murders. Diedrich Asante Muhammad and Sally Sim, how does this inform our discussion on Black wealth inequality, and which some say, and you say in your report, could take African Americans over 500 more years to achieve economic parity with white Americans? Diedrich?
Yes, thank you for that question. And I do think it's really important to note how this celebration, the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, is kind of bookended by the they call it the Battle of Montgomery, as well as this most recent horrific and racist shooting in Jacksonville, Florida. One thing I say oftentimes in my work is that the foundation of racial inequality is racial economic inequality, and the foundation of racial economic inequality is the racial wealth divide. And I think that helps us understand why in the 21st century, we still are dealing with all of these issues of what people are considering, racial tensions, personal prejudice. But I think what really underlies that is the economic, the socioeconomic differences between communities. I think with that steamboat, with that Montgomery battle, you really saw the privilege that these white people in their boat felt, that they didn't have to listen to blacks in authority, that they could even jump a dock worker, or actually it was a captain of the steamboat, attack him, and still hang out there with their boat. And I think this kind of strong socioeconomic difference gives people a sense of entitlement that then boils over into racial controversies. But again, I think the foundation of this is racial economic inequality.
Sally?
Yeah, I would second everything that Diedrich says. I'm in agreement with him. And I think it's really important now, especially since today we're celebrating the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And like Diedrich said, there's just been, and as the report highlights, there's just been a very severe lack of socioeconomic progress for African Americans. I mean, the report highlights that it would take over 500 years to reach any type of economic parity with white households.
Diedrich, the March on Washington 60 years ago, what real gains did it make? I mean, we could spend the whole night talking about this. This is a preface to what we want to do today. But summarize the gains that were made in the war on poverty that resulted from that.
Yes, you know, and I think, you know, like all marches, marches are, you know, public demands, trying to get public attention in order to address issues, right? And again, it was for, it's interesting that the first thing is March on Washington for jobs and freedom. I think most people think of it more abstractly as the March on Washington for civil rights. But, and this comes out of decades of work of the less known leaders of the march, people like A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, who knew that, you know, employment, jobs, economic security was essential to actually bridging economic inequality. So, but what we did see that coming right in 1963, in 1964, you know, you had this war on poverty, Lyndon Johnson, you had a tripling of government spending on such things as health, education, and welfare. You had like the launch of Medicare and Medicaid, expanded housing subsidies, food stamps, employment and training programs, serious investments into those in poverty. And African Americans were disproportionately in poverty. Actually, in 1963, the black poverty rate was 51%. So the majority of African Americans were in income poverty. And just within about 6 years, we saw that decrease to around 32%. So we see with strong investment and with the multifaceted programs, we really can make progress. And today, African American poverty is around 20%, which is, you know, too high, one out of five black Americans, but it's still substantially different than where African Americans were in the early 1960s.
So, Sally, Diedrich, both of you, is it one step forward and two steps back? I mean, what happened? There was that grassroots percolating up, that enormous energy. And of course, the March on Washington was part of a more comprehensive plan of action. The Poor People's March, which was of tremendous significance when Dr. King was assassinated. So what the heck happened? There was this progress. How do we characterize why that progress happened and what the heck happened to what, push us back or push black Americans back to this increasing state again of inequity?
Yeah, let me jump in real quick and just note that I think that's an important thing to look at from 1963, March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, then to 1968, Poor People's Campaign, and the same year Dr. King is assassinated. You know, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom is celebrated, but what's not celebrated are the economic demands. What's celebrated is King's dream. And then by 68, King was even saying that his dream was turning into a nightmare because we weren't making the economic progress. And he's focused on the Poor People's Campaign, which people know much less about. And mm-hmm. we have to remember that the Poor People's Campaign ended with the National Guard kicking out those who had come to D.C. to demand a much stronger economic change than was even being asked for in 1963 with the March on Washington. So I think, you know, there was some political will, I think, with Lyndon Johnson and even the higher levels of poverty among whites to have a war on poverty. But there was not the same type of strong public will to outright end racial economic inequality and bring poverty down to the level of white poverty for African Americans. And I think over the last 30, 40 years, you can also talk about Latinos and other communities of color. So I think we've just seen that kind of resistance building, particularly since, I'll say, the more conservative, regressive Reagan era.
Just a question on this, and Sally, please jump in as well. Boots on the ground, was that the essential component? We came from the civil rights movement, which King then said was about human rights, and also was famous for saying that you really can't, what's the point in some ways of integrating a lunch counter if you don't have the money to buy the hamburger? He said it much more eloquently, of course. But is it boots on the ground that was the essential component of forcing the system to give these concessions? And then, Sally, yourself, as you understand where we are today and what's that ingredients that seems to have pushed us back and increased the wealth divide between people of African ancestry and white people.
Yeah, I'll just note on the boots on the ground comment. I mean, I think, you know, there was strong activism in 63, but in 68 and even in the 70s, like we've had ongoing sense of activism. I just do think that there was a limited political will coming from a more progressive era of the 30s, progressive economically, of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, I think when such a large part of the country experienced poverty to deal with that issue. And there was, you know, some will to deal with ending outright Jim Crow segregation, but the will had never been built to deal with racial economic inequality. And I think Sally can note the lack of progress we had in income and wealth over the last 60 years.
Yeah, I think that the lack of political will to decrease the racial wealth divide is a major factor in all of this. And I also think it's important to reflect on, you know, like the white American middle class didn't always exist and it didn't come to creation in like in a vacuum, right? It was created through federal policy and national practices. You saw that the New Deal and the GI Bill really raised the white American middle class and really built it out. And no such policies or national practices have been afforded to African Americans or other minorities. And that's kind of where, you know, that's why it's still called that white middle class. And even the report says that we continue at the same rate of progress that we've achieved thus far. It would take for income parity, Black households to reach 500, it would take Black households over 500 years to reach the same amount as like white households. And that's not even talking about wealth. For wealth, it's well over 700 years.
So Diedrich, your organization, the National Community Investment Coalition, has authored this new report to put a focus on these issues of both income and wealth inequality. Talk a little bit about more the dimensions of that and also give us some of the suggestions of how to approach this so that we can begin a new movement with new strategy and new demands.
Yes, and so we, NCRC, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, co-authored this with the Institute for Policy Studies, and Institute for Policy Studies is known for their great work and their inequality.org website. And so, you know, I think we hit a challenge of a lack of will to deal with the roots of racial economic inequality. And you saw that even, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and you saw it increasing backlash. Some people call it a white lash with the election of Nixon, though actually Nixon looks like a pretty liberal politician relative to what we'd find in the Republican Party, say, from the 80s on.
What We've a terrifying thought, though, but yes.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a sad thought, but it is true. The amount of programs even anti-poverty programs that Nixon was willing to support compared to what would follow in the Reagan era, where there's this idea of trickle-down economics, and the country really embraced a regressive economy. That is an economy that when the economy grew, it went disproportionately to, almost solely to, the wealthiest of Americans. While in the 40s, 50s, and even 60s, when the economy grew, lower income and moderate income received the greatest benefits. And so we've had, and people have written about this, Piketty most famously, have had a concentration of wealth since, you know, easily around the 1980s for the last 40 years. And so having racial economic progress when there was a lack of will to focus in on the roots of racial economic inequality, and you had a growing regressive economy that actually became a bipartisan consensus for quite a while, I think only recently is starting to be challenged, I think, you know, can be pointed to as the main factor of maintaining this inequality. And this report tries to highlight the type of a progressive policy that could disrupt that and break up concentrated wealth and actually invest in the wealth building needs that's essential to bridging wealth inequality.
What are those policies that Diedrich is referring to, both Diedrich and Sally, in sense of helping us understand what actually happened? What are the regressive policies that has resulted in this astronomical wealth divide? And what are the implications? How does this affect the Black community? I mean, I'm a legal aid lawyer in the civil division. I deal with wealth inequality all the time. Our clients are getting evicted. There's food insecurity, all the rest of it. Not because they don't work very, 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 very hard, but because of the wage level and various other policies that keep people at the bottom of the economic ladder. So if you could explain some of those features and factors to us, it would be very helpful.
Yeah, when we saw during the Reagan era that, you know, Reagan era really and the Reagan period really kind of dismantled as much as possible what was built up in the Great Society, where, again, during that 60s period war on poverty, you had a tripling of spending in terms of education and health care with strong increases in job training. And by 1980, the focus was dismantling these programs, cutting back on those programs, focusing much more on military spending, as well as cutting down taxes that disproportionately benefited the rich. And that's why in our report, you know, we highlight, you know, the need for breaking up this concentrated wealth. And we've in previous reports talked about, you know, a millionaire surtax, a financial transaction tax. You know, currently, we spend about over $700 billion a year in wealth development. It just disproportionately goes to the wealthiest Americans. So we, you know, so this is where we can find the funds to invest in the programs that we also lay out. That maybe Sally want to mention a few of the programs that we think can help address racial wealth inequality and build assets and wealth for low wealth households.
Yeah. Our report has four major areas of recommendations, the first one being full employment and guaranteed jobs. And that's exactly what it sounds like, more good jobs that pay a living wage for everyone who is able to work. The other few recommendations we have are massive land and home ownership programs, such as targeted federal housing policies to help provide down payment assistance to first-time home buyers, specifically living in formerly redlined or officially segregated areas. We go over individual asset building, and that can look like federal baby bond proposals, and that can also look like raising taxes on the ultra wealthy to produce public revenue that can be then invested in creating wealth building opportunities. We also lastly go over reparations and universal health care.
I think two of the things that may be a little bit unknown to people are the reparations. If you could talk about that, we could talk about that all night, but you've got about 2 minutes for that. And baby bonds.
Sure. Let me start with baby bonds. You know, baby bonds is this idea. I think even in the 60s, there's a lot of focus on income and jobs, and that's important. We still have great disparities in that. But there's also an understanding that wealth, having financial reserves that allow you to get through challenging economic times, as well as having financial reserves that allow you to take advantage of economic opportunity and buy a house or buy a car or start a small business are essential. So the idea of baby bonds is that, and it's been proposed by people like Senator Cory Booker, and a couple states have already started a state baby bond program, Connecticut and Washington, D.C., where you put in $3,000, $5,000, even proposes up to $10,000 for either all children or for children of low wealth. And then that builds up over 18, 20 years. And in the case of Connecticut, they estimate every child that could have gotten that would have been on welfare food stamps would be open to about $14,000 to $24,000 of money that they can use for further wealth building opportunities like job training or going to higher education or buying a house or starting a business. So it's, you know, it's investing in long-term asset appreciation that allows young people to start having assets. And then reparations, very briefly, I do believe if we want to target the African American community and bridge this black-white racial wealth divide, it is the most economically effective and efficient way to, instead of having a program that necessarily is hitting all Americans, to focus in on this particular problem and saying we're going to make sure that African Americans, you know, have targeted programs like maybe a full employment program or maybe higher education or community college that is free for everyone who has a ancestor that's experienced Jim Crow segregation, every self-identified black person that's experienced Jim Crow segregation or maybe has an ancestor in enslavement, and having particular programs of reparations to repair that black-white wealth divide. And I do think that is a central part and fundamental if we really want to address the racial wealth divide that Dr. King was talking about.
How can
Yeah, and
people go ahead,
I'll just
Sally,
note here.
sorry.
Yeah, of course. I'll just note here that, you know, certain geographic areas do have like draft proposals that are non-binding. For example, the city of San Francisco has put forward a non-binding draft of a reparations plan that allocates $5 million to each eligible African American resident as reparations. Now, this may not be financially feasible, but the plan really underscores that 10 trillion racial wealth divide for African Americans. And I think, you know, even if the plan that doesn't really come ever to fruition, it's an important step to take.
Deidre Kassante Mohammed, tell us how people can get the report, where they can find it, read it, and just if you can punctuate this discussion in the last minute or two that we have, if you can just punctuate that discussion with that opening that I went into, that if why do you integrate a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy what's served in the counter? The
Sure.
importance of beginning to deal with in a critical way and not wait 500 years, the wealth inequality
No,
as a way
that's
of
right.
reaching egalitarianism.
Yep. I mean, because you can take down the colored and white water fountains or colored and white signs, but if it costs a certain amount to enter into neighborhoods, you're just reproducing segregation. And that's why economic equality is an essential part of bridging into racial equality. And if you want to find more about the report and the work we do around community economic development across the country, we have 750 membership organizations across the country. You can go to our website, www.ncrc.org. You can also look at the important work of the Institute for Policy Studies and their analysis and their policy proposals on addressing economic inequality by going to inequality.org. Those are the two websites. You should be able to get plenty of information on these things.
And you think you can join us at an entire hour roundtable, at least, to really flesh out all these issues?
Would very much enjoy it.
I thank you very much.
Deidre Kassante Mohammed and Sally Sim with the National Community Investment Coalition, NCRC, keep doing the work you do to educate, agitate, and organize for Black Lives Matter.
Thank you, my friends.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And we say educate, educate, and organize for another world is possible if we choose to make it so.
We shall all